Right, welcome back to the podcast, the Stephen Sully Study. I don't do many part twos, but I had to do it with Mr. Matt Letitia. Thank you very much for your time, Matt. And pleasure is all mine, as always.
Thank you, mate. No, it's good to talk to you again.
So, I can't believe the first conversation that you and I had at your home in your garden on a very fine summer's day was back in 2022. Wow. A lot has changed since then. Well, it seems like a lot has changed. I want to talk about sport, football, and how things have changed in the last couple of years, but also from when you was a footballer to now. I think the obvious thing is the money. I was doing a bit of research earlier. The highest paid footballer, according to Forbes today, is Ronaldo. $260 million he pulled in 2023, according to them. And Messi pulled in $135 million in 2023. Do you think that money takes the edge away from the game of football?
I would say you have to be a incredibly special character to not allow the money to affect your performance levels and your motivation to want to be the best footballer you possibly can be. I think in a lot of cases, money has ruined some footballers and has made them a little bit complacent in terms of getting the best out of what they could possibly have done. But there are also some real exceptions to that, where you have people like Cristiano Ronaldo, who, despite the vast amounts of wealth that he's had, he's still looked after himself incredibly well, and he's performed to ridiculously high levels for long periods of time. So there's a little bit of a mixture, but I would say that in a lot of cases, yes, money too soon just takes the edge off of some players.
Even though I was never pro, my choice of sport is boxing, if you remember when we had the first conversation. And clearly, if you're from, I don't know, sort of a slightly deprived background or hadn't had it easy coming up as a boxer, and you're winning all these belts and you're winning, you know, most of your fights, etc., the moment you start getting £10-20 million a fight, you can clearly see that some of that fight is taken out of you. And I think if you look at someone like a Tyson Fury in his last fight against Ngannou, maybe clearly some of it was down to lack of preparation, taking his eye off the ball, maybe not treating Ngannou as a proper boxing competitor. But also, if you're getting $60 million for that fight, surely it's going to take some of the spite away from your training.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, you've got to be a pretty special character to be able to still train to the levels you used to when you were skinny, when you've got, you know, tens of millions of quid in the bank. And that is obviously going to have some kind of effect on a lot of people. That's not to say that there aren't some special ones out there who will still train to the standards that they always have done, because that's, you know, they've got that discipline and that personal pride in their performance. And that, I think, is what sets apart the real greats from the mere mortals.
I think I know the answer to this next question, because I feel like I've got to know you via other podcasts and also meeting you for you know, first time a couple of years ago. You done well as a footballer, and you done clearly quite well financially because you've got a nice home, nice lifestyle, etc. But there's doing really well as far as you're concerned, and then there's the likes of Messi, Ronaldo, etc., which is extreme wealth. Do you ever look at today's footballers and think, I wish I was kind of in today's era, because with my talents and my penalty scoring record, for example, I could have been raking in, I don't know, 50 million quid a year?
No, I still would choose to play in the era that I played in. I felt like we had a lot more fun back in our day. There was a lot more freedom about our lifestyles. You know, we weren't scrutinized by social media every single football match. We also, you know, didn't have camera phones all over the place when we were, you know, socializing out and about after a game. And so it was a lot. It was a lot better atmosphere to be a professional footballer in. I think the boys these days have to be so careful about, you know, where they go, what they drink, where they're seen. So I, even with the vast amounts of money that are available today, I never played football for the money. I played football because I loved the sport. And so I would always choose to have played in the era that I played in because I just felt like it was so much more fun.
I know it's a bit of a fantasy question, but if you were a young man again today, playing with Marcus Rashford, Gary Kane, Jack Grealish, etc., how do you think you would have fared with your fellow Englishmen in the same football squad?
I wouldn't have felt out of place. I don't think there's any football team in the world that I could have walked into that I wouldn't have felt out of place. I always had a lot of confidence in my own ability. I knew I was good at football, I certainly wouldn't have felt out of place in the company of Kane or Grealish and people like that. That's for sure.
I always see, let's say, back in the day, and I'm not talking about too long ago, but, you know, let's call it, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I feel like football or footballers were certainly a lot more tougher back then than they are today. I think there's a bit of gamesmanship today, which is you're dropping on the floor to try and win that penalty or win that free kick. And I get that. I get there's a strategy behind it. But also at the same time, I think it breeds a bit of softness. And I think weakness, softness, and people, they begin to become a bit fragile. And if you look at the Dennis Wises, if you look at the Vinnie Joneses, if you look at certain people back in the day, they were certainly a lot more feared, fierce, and aggressive. Do you think the game of football today is a lot more fairy-like?
Yeah, it's definitely a softer version of the game that I played. That's for sure. You know, most teams back in our day had, you know, somebody you could call like an enforcer, you know, somebody who was, you know, in the middle of the pitch, who was going to stick their foot into a tackle, who wasn't afraid to throw themselves into a 50-50 challenge and weren't afraid to get hurt for their team. You know, I don't really see that. Now, some people will see that as a positive, you know, because, you know, it's the beautiful game and, you know, football should be played, you know, on the ground, and, you know, it should all look lovely. But for me, football's about more than that. Football is, even though I was one of those players who probably would have benefited from the rules of today, where, you know, it's so much softer and, you know, defenders can't tackle in the way that they used to, you know, red cards are dished out way too easily. As somebody who would have benefited from that, I still think that there is a part of the game that is combative and is a physical challenge. You know, physical challenge should be allowed. 50-50 tackle, a good 50-50 tackle can be as exciting to fans as somebody sticking one in the top corner from 25 yards. You know, I've seen games change and atmospheres in football matches change on the back of a really good, solid 50-50 tackle, which, you know, your team won, the crowds get lifted, the players get lifted, and all of a sudden the dynamics in the game change. I don't feel like football is way better because of the changes in the rules that have happened.
Okay, it sort of answered my next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. VAR, is it a good thing for football or a bad thing for football?
I don't think it's quite as black and white as that. I think it could be a good thing for football if it was used properly. I think the people that are using it are not very good at it, to put it mildly. I think they've messed up. They've taken a good idea and they've completely messed it up with their implementation of it, in my opinion. The way that it's being implemented at the moment, the way that it's being used and the people that are running it, I don't think it's very good for the game. I think it's had far more negative impact than it has positive, I think, at the moment. If it was run by the right people and if it was run properly, then I think it could be really useful and could be a net positive for the game, but at the moment it isn't.
And overall, with the state of English football, the Premiership, How do you think it's doing in relation to like rival leagues across Europe?
I think at the moment the Premier League, well, certainly this season's Premier League, is shaping up to be one of the best run-ins, you know, one of the tightest run-ins with three teams involved than we've had for a long time. You know, this has the real possibility of perhaps getting down to the last match of the season with three teams still able to win the Premier League, you know, and that would be quite something. I'm not sure we've had that for many a year. So in terms of that, it's in pretty good shape. I think there's some poor teams in the Premier League this season, though. I really do at the bottom. I think Sheffield United and Burnley have really kind of stunk the place out, really, and haven't really been that competitive, which is a shame because I think the strength of the Premier League is that you can normally have, you know, a decent amount of teams there that will pick up a reasonable enough amount of points that, you know, they can go into the last couple of games of the season still thinking they can stay up. I don't think that's going to happen with Sheffield United or with Burnley. I think they're going to be relegated with quite a few games to go by the looks of it. And that's a bit of a shame that they weren't really strong enough to compete at that level. But at the top end, I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, agreed. Going back to the whole money in football, Saudi Arabia, I know they was around when we done the first podcast, but it really does feel in the last couple of years, they've put their foot on the gas and said, right, we want to become the biggest, the best, the most glamorous place in the world for entertainment and sport. Again, I'm a boxing fan and I'm really excited about this weekend's fight. You've got Anthony Joshua against Ngannou and you've also got Zhang against Joseph Parker, which again, I think equally is a really, really good fight. I just can't help but think this is really good for the fighters. I think they need to seize the opportunity. But long term, is this going to damage the world of sport? The question to you is, you know, with all these big players going over to Saudi Arabia now, is it just going to suck all the other leagues dry of all the good high-profile players?
It's a good question. It's a question that was kind of raised about 8 or 9 years ago. And I don't know if you remember, but the Chinese were throwing silly money around at the time. You know, we had a centre forward at Southampton called Graziano Pella, who was doing, you know, pretty well for us. And he was snapped up by a team in China and became one of the top earning footballers in the whole world, you know, in the blink of an eye, from playing at Southampton in the Premier League on what was probably a modest wage in terms of Premier League. He was suddenly elevated to like the second, I think it was, highest earner in football. And China threw a hell of a lot of money for a short amount of time at it. And then all of a sudden they just changed their mind and decided, no, that's not sustainable. That's not the way it's going to go. And all of a sudden the money dried up. So it will be interesting to see just how long Saudi Arabia will continue with throwing the amount of money that they're throwing at it, because I don't think it'll ever kind of get the kind of gravitas that the Premier League holds, or, you know, the Bundesliga or La Liga. And so I think for me, this will be something that will probably fizzle out in a few years' time in terms of the amounts of silly money that they're throwing around for footballers. I might be wrong, and you know, it might go on to become the best league in the world, but I think I'd be a very surprised man if that happened.
It's almost forcing the hand as well of other clubs worldwide. If they want to retain some of their superstars, they need to start chucking out silly money as well. Was it Mepe? I'm not, you know, a massive football fan. I obviously appreciate it.
Yeah.
But I think I read somewhere that, you know, his current club had to kind of offer him a ridiculous amount of money because if not, the Saudis might have stepped in.
Yeah, I mean, agents will use the Saudi Arabia thing to get better deals for their clients. Even if the clients aren't really interested in going to play in Saudi Arabia, they can, you know, dangle that in front of the clubs. But at the end of the day, I think for me, the football clubs have to stand firm and just say, look, this is our model. This is what we can afford to pay you. If you don't like it, then by all means, leave. And you know what? If that's the kind of player that they've got on their books there, why would they want to keep him if all he's interested in is more money, more money, more money? You know, at some point, the football clubs have to draw a line in the sand and say, look, this is what we can afford. You want to play for us? There's your contract. Sign it. If you don't want to sign and want play for us for that amount of money, which, by the way, you're never going to struggle for the rest of your life, or probably several generations of your family won't struggle for the rest of their lives with what we're paying you, then they have to draw a line in the sand and go, well, sorry, that's what we can afford. Off you pop, you know, and we'll look somewhere else for our players.
Hmm. Have you been to Saudi Arabia, Matt?
I think I did go to Saudi Arabia for we had a mid-season friendly out there with Southampton many years ago. In fact, it was I'm sure there was the war on in the Gulf actually when we flew there, because we were a little bit concerned about how close it was to the war zone, but we were told that we weren't that close to it.
Okay, all right. Would is there been talks?
It was a long time ago.
Okay. Is there been talks in recent months or years about you maybe going over there to share some of your wisdom and being a pundit?
Yeah, no. Unfortunately, the Saudi Arabia money hasn't filtered into the world of ex-Sky pundits at the moment. So, no, I'm still unemployed on the football pundit front on the television at the moment.
Are you seeking a new role, a new job in somewhere like an equivalent of Sky Sports?
Hey, listen, if jobs come along and they're a decent enough company and I feel like it's something that I want to do, then I will always consider it. But you know, it's not something that's on my bucket list. I've got, you know, 15 years of experience under me in the Sky Sports department, and you know, I've kind of ticked that box. And you know, maybe if something crops up, I'll consider it. But it's not something that I'm, you know, desperate to go back and do.
If Sky Sports today theoretically got down on their knees and said, Matt, you were right, mate. We want you back. We want to give you lots of money. We are deeply sorry. Would you go back?
They could shove it right up their backside, mate. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't go back to there. Not unless there's been a completely clean sweep of who owns the company and the direction that it's going in, and I can't see that happening anytime soon. So yeah, that's a bit of a moot point, I'd say.
Hmm. Not to press on the point too much, but like, because you were so close together, you had a lot of success together, and it almost felt like you were chucked under the bus slightly. Yeah. Does it cross your mind each and every single day? Is there a little bit of sort of anger, bitterness there, or you kind of want to get some kind of revenge, not in a violent way, but just beaten with ultimate success, maybe, Matt?
I've already beaten them in my own mind, because I'm the happiest version of myself that I could possibly be. So I don't harbour any resentment. I don't harbour grudges. I just go about my life and be the happiest I can be, and that'll be enough to piss them off.
Yeah, okay. I just want to go back to the football point just quickly. So a bit of a random question. We spoke about how the game has evolved, and I do believe the older school footballers were certainly a lot more tougher. Now there's both sides of the argument, which is the better version of the, what's the best version of the, you know, the perfect footballer, and that's a sort of a side conversation that we can have in a minute. I want to ask you this question. Is headering the ball from a very young age a good thing to do?
No, my opinion on it is that I don't think it's necessary for young kids to be heading heavy footballs. I don't think there's any need for that at all. I think as they get into their teenage years, I think, you know, perfecting your heading technique by using lighter balls where the damage isn't going to be anywhere near, I think is a pretty good idea. And I think excessive heading is something that doesn't need to be done in training. But I would stop at the point where they're, I don't know if they're going to try and go down this route of actually banning heading in football matches, because that's kind of where it seems to be going. I wouldn't go that far. I don't think, it's important that everybody is given the freedom of choice. You know, I think we, as human beings, we should have free will. So I think as long as everybody knows the dangers that are involved, then I think that should be enough. And if people want to say, no, I'm, I'm, I don't want to play football because I, you know, I might get dementia later on if I head the ball too many times. That's fine. But by the same token, you should also be able to have players to say, okay, I know what the dangers are. And I'm ready to take that risk, you know. And I think as the technology has moved on and with the standard of the football, you know, and the lightness of the football now, I would say that probably this generation of players probably won't suffer in the way that the generation of players from before mine suffered. And to be fair, some of mine that I played with. So I think that's my kind of view on it all. I don't think it's a black and white subject. I think there's sensible measures you can take to protect the kids. But I think as you get into adulthood, I think you should be able to make your own decision, given that you've been given all the information available and all the risks available, and you should be able to make your own decision from that.
Do you know what? I guess, and I know in the heat of training or heat of a game, it's obviously very, very hard to determine how you're going to head at the ball. Clearly on the front of your head is certainly better than somewhere else.
Yeah.
Do you think there is some real risks of forming dementia because of misheading the ball too many times?
Yeah, I guess it's a possibility. You know, you've also got to take into account, I guess, the clashes of heads that take place on occasion. So, but again, that's something that players are aware of when they become footballers. You know the risks. You know you might break a leg. You know you might suffer a concussion. But, you know, we play the game regardless of that because we feel like we can mitigate those risks to a certain extent. And we love the game so much that we want to play it. We want to entertain people. Nobody wants to get injured. And we know it's a possible risk. But what's life if there is no risk? Bloody boring, if you ask me.
Yeah, definitely. On the note of football, Ronaldo or Messi, who do you think is the GOAT?
I would say Messi. I think from a naturally gifted side of things, I would say Messi is probably just the slightly more naturally gifted. I think Cristiano is more of a man-made footballer. But both of them have been absolutely outstanding for a long period of time. And they will both be in every conversation from here on in when people talk about, you know, the best players to have graced the game.
I don't know Ronaldo. I've never been in contact with Ronaldo. I've never even seen Ronaldo, okay? But looking at some of the documentaries out there and you get a little bit of flavour of his personality, it's clear to see that he's a winner, he's a champion, and he's very competitive. Do you think he's slightly jealous that Messi won the World Cup?
That's a good question. I don't know Cristiano well enough to say whether or not that would have affected him. Obviously, he has pride. He wants to be the best player in the world, and he is a competitive animal. So there's probably a little bit inside of him that thinks, "God, I wish that was me." But you know, unless you really know Cristiano personally, then it's difficult to answer that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you're a man who believes freedom of speech, and we spoke about this quite a lot in 2022. Cashless, cryptocurrency, central currency, electric cars, are all these things good for humanity, or do you think they're going to restrict us?
Well, I think central bank digital currencies will certainly restrict everything. I think that is a very dangerous route to go down. I think there is controls on those things that can be put in place that will make your life very difficult if you choose to, you know, criticize the government, you know, eat too much meat, you know, put too much petrol in your car. I think a cashless society is a very dangerous one for me. I'm not in favor of that kind of stuff. I think anything that allows us to do things where the government can't interfere is a good thing, quite frankly, because I don't trust my government.
I don't trust your government in what way?
I don't trust my government to spend the taxes that we give them responsibly.
Okay. And when you said about a cashless society, don't think it's a good thing, in what way as well? Why do you think it's dangerous?
Because it gives the government, your government, who are not necessarily very nice people, it gives them control over your life, over what you can spend your money on. And I think Every person who goes out to work and earns a living, they should be able to spend their money on whatever they choose to and not what the government chooses them to.
Agreed, mate. Agreed. The schooling system.
Yep.
What is your view on the schooling system as it is right now?
I think it's disgusting at the moment. I think the schooling system is an indoctrination center. I think it has been a system that's been abused by the radical far left to get their little agendas into the schools and trying to, you know, teach little kids that, you know, transgenderism, you know, that's okay and you can be whoever you want to be. I think they should leave the kids alone. If they want to make those decisions when they're adults, then by all means, let them make those decisions, but stop indoctrinating kids into the slightly more nefarious sexual deviances, and even teaching kids, you know, some of the stuff they're teaching kids at a young age is just disgusting. It's perverted. It shouldn't be done to children. Children of that age should not be talking about that kind of stuff. And for me, it's a form of grooming, and I'm not very happy with it.
I really get the sensation that with what you're saying now, and there's so many of it I do agree with, then I look at where I live, which is London, such a great place, such a powerful place, such a place full of opportunity. But then there's the dark side of it, which is the stabbings, the muggings, the crimes, the gang-like culture. And it seems to be getting more and more dangerous. I remember years ago that you could walk down the street with a Rolex watch and you could have a nice bag, or you could be, you know, walking freely, and there was no concern, unless it was maybe really, really late at night or early hours in the morning, that, you know, you didn't feel vulnerable. Now, it seems like a bit of a war zone sometimes. Why do you think that is? Why do you think places like major cities in the UK, including London, have become so hostile?
I think that's been done deliberately, and I think Sadiq Khan has had a lot to do with that, quite frankly, in London. Although even before that, I'd seen London going downhill. It appears to me that the politicians in this country are quite willfully and quite deliberately bringing this country to its knees by their financial decisions and their policies that they make. And I feel like there's some other agenda behind it. And I'm sure it will come to light in the future, but that's what it feels like to me at the moment. And I hope beyond hope that I'm wrong, because I don't want to see us go down that route. But it doesn't feel like we're going in a great direction in this country at the moment, as you said.
In an ideal world, who would you like to see step in and take over?
What, in our government?
Yeah.
There ain't too many. I think probably Andrew Bridgen is the only MP that's really shown any kind of balls to stand up in Parliament and talk about stuff that is in the best interests of people in this country. But I don't like the system that we've got at the moment. I don't trust any of the political parties that we've got in, you know, the major political parties, not having any of them. So I won't be voting for any of them at the next general election. I don't know what we can do. I would prefer, personally, if I had a magic wand, I'd prefer a more of a Swiss style direct democracy, where they have way more referendums on things that are important to the country. And I think this two-party system that we've got in this country needs to go. Otherwise, this country is just going to keep getting worse.
Where do you actually see the country in the next 5 or 10 years if it carries on the way it's going?
Oh, if it carries on the way it's going, I see a place probably where a lot of British people will be considering their future in this country. As you say, in the major cities, people are now concerned for their welfare. You know, if they look like they've got a few quid and might have an expensive wrist on their watch, and I don't think that's a country that I recognise, quite frankly. I never, you know, I've been over in England now for best part of 40 years, and I can honestly say in that time, we haven't gotten better as a society, let's put it that way.
I know we don't live in America, Matt, but it almost feels a little bit like the UK is a younger brother of America sometimes, because whatever what happens over there happens over here. Donald Trump, would it be a good thing if he gets back in power?
It's quite strange that in America, you know, you've got the choice of Donald Trump or Joe Biden at the last election. Now, it looks like it's going to be the same again for this election. Now, if you look at the two records, I think out of the two of them, I would prefer the president that didn't start any wars, quite frankly, and that's Donald Trump, because I think we should be, in this day and age, we should be able to sort out our differences with negotiations rather than having to resort to, you know, shelling and killing innocent women, children, you know, the armed forces being thrown to the wolves for what? For the just so that the arms makers can make lots of money. There's massive transfers of wealth going on when there's wars going on. And, you know, you've only got to look at the wars and see who benefits from it to see who are the ones that are starting the wars. And quite frankly, I'd prefer a president in charge who didn't want wars. And that appeared to be Donald Trump.
The other thing as well, Matt, is I don't know any of these presidents personally, and I can only go off what I see online and what I read and what people, the opinions, right? But look at it face value. Joe Biden falls over everywhere. He forgets what he's saying. He comes up with ridiculous kind of, I don't know, like scenarios. And it's like, how this guy can't even string a sentence together. How is he even running the most powerful organization in the world? I mean, is Joe Biden a bit, is he a bit of a
puppet? He's not,
puppet?
Stephen, let's be honest. He's not, yeah. Is he? He's not running anything. He's literally the puppet front man. There's clearly forces behind him that are running things. He's just the bloke that they put in front of the cameras, and he's not doing a very good job of that either.
I mean, at least if you're going to put a puppet in front of us all, have someone that can stand up. I mean, the guy trips up all the time. They had to lead him off of a stage because he didn't know how to get off. I mean, this is crazy.
It is crazy. I don't know. I don't know how he's managed to stay there that long. I mean, it's clear that he's got some kind of cognitive disease going on there. There's something not quite right, but hey ho.
Yeah. Right. Since the time where you departed from Sky Sports was very vocal about what was going on, lockdown, etc., I'm keen to know, from wearing your glasses for 1 second, you know, living in your shoes, as you walk around, you know, your local area, as you walk around in major cities, as you travel around the world, there must be people that come up to you, forgetting you're Matt Letizier, who was the footballer. They must come over to you and go, you know what, Matt? You were right. Or some people might go, you know what, right, Matt? No, what? You weren't right. What is the general feeling? What is the general comments they make to you when people approach you?
Well, I can tell you that the ratio of people coming up to me and thanking me for sticking my neck out over the last few years is way more than anybody who's come up to me and said that I was a conspiracy theorist or an anti-vaxxer or whatever the mainstream media labels like to put on me. The general public have been absolutely brilliant, to be honest with you. They've been very supportive. And I can honestly say it's been an absolute pleasure to be out in public and to see so many people who are, you know, prepared to come up and sometimes actually go, do you know what, Matt? I thought you were mad a couple of years ago, but actually you were right. And that's certainly not the reason why I did it. It's nice to hear, but that's not the reason why we do these things. We do it because we believe that what was done to us was wrong by our governments, and we're standing up for all good people who I thought were absolutely conned into ruining their businesses, ruining their lives, you know, separated from their families when they were, when their parents were dying, kids were dying in hospital with nobody able to visit them, you know, couldn't go to people's funerals. It was just disgusting what went on. And people are appreciative of the fact that I wasn't afraid to speak out and to say what I thought on the matters that were happening.
Hmm. I think actually since we've done the podcast, one key thing, because we spoke about censorship and people being blocked on social media because of their views and the way they're talking online. But someone that is kind of allowed us to get back to freedom of speech has been Elon Musk since he's taken over Twitter again. I mean, he's actually allowed certain people's Twitter accounts to be re-engaged. Is there a little bit of a, you know, is the tide turning slightly now?
I think there was certainly some optimism there. I think there's still some shenanigans going on at X, as it's called now, in terms of the algorithms and, you know, some people's accounts being suppressed. You know, the new lady that took over there, that Elon Musk put in charge, was a World Economic Forum stooge. And she came up with the, you know, freedom of, you can have freedom of speech, but not freedom of reach, which means, you know, you can say what you want, but we're going to suppress your tweets and nobody, hardly anybody's going to be able to see it if we don't agree with it, which is not freedom of speech at all. I've got my doubts as to whether or not X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it, is actually a proper free speech platform.
Okay. And what would you say the best free speech platform is in the world?
The best free speech platform you've got is when you're speaking to your neighbour, when you're speaking to the public, when you're speaking to people face-to-face. That's the only time you got your real free speech.
Yeah. Look, Matt, I know you've probably got stuff to do. Really, really pleasure again speaking to you, mate. Like I said, I'd love to get you into the gallery, show you around when you're next in London, have a coffee with you.
And thanks, mate.
I'm trying to remember. You're not a beer drinker, you're a vodka drinker.
Malibu drinker.
Malibu drinker, that was it. Is it Malibu and pineapple?
No, Malibu and Coke.
Malibu and Coke, bloody hell. I haven't drunk that since I went to Zante with the boys. All right, well, look.
Nice one, mate.
Thank you very much. God bless, and I'll speak to you soon.